I'll be the first to admit that I used to be a major asshole. I used to make a living as an armed robber. No joke. And I was mostly targeting big chains with cash that was on site. This is sort of a confession. Their employees never gave a crap to really do anything, whereas you rob a mom and pop shop, and you tend to get less mom and more pop, 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 if you know what I mean. I'm trying to make light of it, but either way, I rob places because I was addicted to heroin. I did just about anything and everything I could get my hands on, but my main thing was H, and to get it, I had to roll with some pretty terrible people. It wasn't so bad if I was around my home turf. I knew the right places to go and the right people to talk to. But whenever I was off on business, which tended to be frequent as you don't want to poop where you eat, as they say, I had to attach myself to certain other folks if I wanted to get what I needed. And I mean it, man. I rolled with some very scary dudes back in the day, but none as scary as Tyran and Lash DeFour. The one and only time I met one of them was when I was down in Georgia, running drugs for some biker gang down there. The DeFours used to make this really killer meth, military grade shit, but they only ever sold in bulk from this compound that they had out in the sticks, and they only ever met you in this one place, away from their cookhouse so no one could find it. It was hard to get a hold of them, even harder to put an order in for a shipment, as they usually sold everything to this group of guys down in Florida to keep their profile low. But this one time, I get told to drive out to that drop site and wait until either Tyran or Lash showed up with the shipment. And so, I drive out to the place, wait there a while, and then this big shirtless dude comes walking out of the woods carrying a backpack. The dude is covered in tattoos with what looked like a really bad hair dye job, but what I later learned was the fumes from him cooking so much bleaching his hair. Anyway, he walks up, looking like I'm something that he found on his shoe, and we make the exchange before he starts asking about people that I'd never even heard of. And the dude was completely whacked out on something, because he kept like staring at me in confusion whenever I'd say, "Dude, I don't know who you're talking about here, sorry." He seemed like mad at first, like I was lying to him or something, but then on his last name he just started laughing as if to be like, "Whatever, dude." And after that he walked off back into the woods to wherever the hell his compound was, and I drove back to the shop to drop the shipment and collect my payment. A couple of hours later, I'm linking up with a buddy of mine to score some H when I start telling him about the creepy spacey dude that I met out in the woods. The second I get to telling him about this guy's tattoos, he starts asking if I knew the guy's name. Then when I told him it was either Tyran or Lash, he starts making faces as if to say, "Hot damn, you just walked into the lion's den and only got out again by the grace of God." And my buddy then goes about telling me about everything he knows about the DeFour brothers, and everything he'd heard anyway. So these DeFour brothers lived out there in the woods in some hidden compound that they'd built with their own hands, completely off the grid. It was just a lab cookhouse at first, and all the necessary equipment, but I guess they got sick of driving to and from all the time, and decided to just live out there full time so they could work whatever they wanted to, day or not, without any interruptions whatsoever. And according to the guy I hooked up afterwards to score some H with, the way the DeFour brothers guaranteed no interruptions was to booby trap the surrounding area with the kinds of stuff that you only see in Vietnam movies. Spike pits, swing and trigger traps, and they even had tripwire grenades strung up in the trees where only Lash or Tyran could see them. I was told that every so often a deer would trigger one of the traps, and that mostly that's how they got their food. But to keep the people at bay, the DeFours had to get a little more creative. The devil traps, I heard them called bird traps too, they look like those little stickmen things from the Blair Witch movie. I don't know how creepy people would find them these days, that movie's 25 years old now, but they sure would have worked on anyone who'd seen that movie. I remember listening to all that and thinking, Sure, they sound dangerous, but at least they just want to be left alone. Well, the Dufour brothers did want to be left alone, but only during working hours. The trouble was, they weren't exactly the men-about-town types. Both had multiple warrants, so they couldn't exactly stroll into town for a few cocktails without cops throwing their butts in jail. So instead of going to the party, the Dufours brought the party to them. And they were swimming in cash. Crystal, they sold LSD, so they used to get a whole bunch of girls out there to spend a few days with them whenever they wanted to party. Professionals, you know what I'm saying? They were there to smoke bowls and get paid, but they always got way, way more than they bargained for. No girl ever went twice. They wouldn't. They had to get these new girls in, ignorant ones, or ones who knew that they could spend a few days getting high as a kite, if they could only put up with Tyran and Lash's proclivities, I'll just say. My buddy said that he didn't know exactly what they used to get up to, but that he had heard from one girl that the Dufour brothers liked scaring girls that they had delivered to him. They used to dose him up with a bunch of drugs, and then do all kinds of things to him, try to make him lose their minds. I heard some really weren't ever the same again, and that some of them disappeared afterwards, wanting to get as far away from the Dufour brothers as possible. I heard they were into some weird religious stuff out there too, something like Santeria, but probably a lot more like devil worship by the sounds of it. Supposedly, Lash and Tyran used to get high as hell, light fires, cut the heads off of animals they trapped, and then drink the blood in these messed up, meth-fueled ritual-type binges. They had all kinds of old books lying around on witchcraft and Satanism and how you can, like, open up portals with your mind if you think on it real hard. All kinds of crazy crap like that. I think Lash had all sorts of devil tattoos too. Like it wasn't just a style thing for him. They really believed it. I mean, they always said those boys were crazy. And with all the drugs and crystal meth out there, I can believe they smoked themselves onto another freaking planet. Another time, someone had to go back to their compound for some reason, and after avoiding all the booby traps and all of that, they found Lash Dufour had a friend with him. Whoever it was hadn't seen this new friend around before, which was weird because it was usually only people they really trusted that ever saw the compound, and he'd been working with them for a year by then, so that was to be expected. But then, to see this young-looking kid, maybe 19 or 20, sitting there all whacked out looking like he was having a bad trip, that gave our visitor all kinds of bad vibes, especially when he saw how Lash was messing with him. The kid didn't seem like he was having fun at all, and he even got up and tried to get away. Lash just started laughing, tripped the kid up, and then threw him back on their outdoor couch before telling him to stay put. Lash was always messing with people like that, I mean. He loved doing it with hookers, and he'd do it with his friends, too. And the only thing was, the kid's face was on the news for weeks afterwards. He went missing, and never showed up again. Then there was this one time these two guys tried screwing the Dufour brothers over. Very sly, too, slipping them a few fake bills into a stack. Anyway, it didn't slip by them. But instead of going after him and taking what was theirs up front, the Dufour brothers pretended not to notice. They went along with it, really made the guys that they were selling to, making them think that they were idiots. And then one day, the boys invite their business partners over for a few drinks and no one ever sees them again. I heard Tyran still talks about their skulls, like he gets all messed up on whatever they got over there and then just stares at them, laughing sometimes like they're telling him jokes that no one else can hear. After my buddy finishes telling me about the Dufour brothers, I think about every hair on my body was stood up on end, knowing I'd avoided a similar fate to some of the other poor folks that had made it out near their compound. Made me real glad that I only ever had to deal with them that one time, because get on those boys' bad side and I don't think I'd ever gone anywhere near the state of Georgia ever again. There's some real psychos out there in the world, and the less time you spend around them, the better. I grew up in this one-horse town out in Kansas. My parents owned a small general store but still struggled to make ends meet. Whenever I wasn't at school or playing over at a friend's house, I used to hang out at the store and do odd jobs for my parents. Nothing that'd break any child labor laws, just odds and ends to keep me occupied. One day I remember this guy turning up to the store, kind of weird looking, and the way he looked at me made me not want to be around him. He'd stop by every so often, and whenever he did, I always tried to stay away from him. But this one time, while he was browsing, my dad stepped into the back and I was alone with the creepy customer for a minute or two. I remember walking to another aisle which towered over me at that age and trying to stay out of that guy's sight, but I remember standing there, then seeing him lean around the corner of the shelf like one of those velociraptors in Jurassic Park with that big smile on his face. I think I was too nervous to just run off, or maybe just not quite scared enough. But I remember standing there, trying not to look at him, and he came closer and kneeled down beside me. When he said hello, I had no choice but to look at him. I remember thinking that he was going to ask my name and really not wanting to tell him. But instead of asking me anything, he just told me how special I was. It was super weird, because I remember going from thinking that he was a creep to thinking, maybe this guy isn't so bad after all. But then, what he said next, I just found confusing. He told me, "Little ladies like you are the most precious thing in the whole wide world," he said. "And the key to everything is right inside here." And as he said that last part, he poked my tummy, soft, with one finger. I wasn't scared, I was just confused. He obviously didn't mean any harm, but at the same time, I knew he was still a stranger and not to be trusted. The guy paid for his stuff and left, and I waited until he was out of earshot before telling my dad about what the man had said and done. I was also confused as to why my dad seemed so angry, and it was Mom who had to explain that it wasn't okay for any stranger to touch me anywhere for any reason at all. They told me that I did the right thing. And apparently the guy came back a few days later only for my dad to chase him out of the store and tell him to never come back. A few years go by and I was still too young to really remember this, but Mom and Dad said that one day the creepy guy's face was all over the papers after state troopers had raided the house that he lived in out in the middle of nowhere. He was living out in some old house with no electricity, no running water, basically living like some doomsday prepper completely detached from society. And with him were a bunch of female relatives, ones that he was inbreeding with. I think they must have rescued about half a dozen of those girls, most of them products of incest, and even though it was a huge, huge story, my parents managed to keep me pretty sheltered from it until I ended up finding out on my own. I was much older then, but it wasn't much easier to take realizing what the guy meant when he said, "The key to everything is right inside here." And it makes me sick to my stomach that people like that are just existing out there like they do. And it makes me feel even sicker that I had one of them lay his dirty, rotten finger right on me. I suppose he thought that he was letting me in on a little wisdom of his, when really, he was showing me what a sick, evil bastard he was deep down.
This happened when I was 12 years old at an all-boys sleepaway camp in 2010. It was nicknamed Camp Boone in the Carolinas and was a one-week camp for kids who were mainly into the outdoors. It's a really nice camp in the middle of the woods with lots of streams, hiking trails, and even a big lake. It wasn't exactly Boy Scouts or anything, but just the sheer desire for kids my age to have a good summer. We do have to watch out for bears, black panthers, and even black widows, which were all native to North Carolina. The first day we had gotten there, our camp counselor had told us to unpack our belongings and to put them in our assigned cabins. We'd be staying in these small cabins appropriate for about four campers. The first few days went pretty well for the most part, with us doing several activities around the camp. These activities usually ranged anywhere from archery to whitewater rafting. However, it was that Thursday night where things took an unexpected turn. It was around 6 p.m., and our group had just finished eating at the dining hall in the lodge. After we had eaten, our camp counselors had gathered our group to go roast marshmallows by the fire pit. Now, the way that this fire pit is set up is that it's located a little ways away from the camp in the woods. Basically, you had to go through this trail that led into a large clearing, and in the center of that was the fire pit. In other words, it was surrounded by a bunch of trees which could easily catch on fire. We all sat down on the provided chairs around the campfire where we had begun sharing stories and making s'mores. Anyway, it's around 9 p.m. at night, and one of the counselors was telling us a story about his scary experience working the night shift. As he's about halfway through the story, our whole group suddenly hears what sounded like a large branch snap from somewhere in the woods. Everyone immediately goes quiet, as if a switch were turned off. Keep in mind that we were quite a ways away from the campsite, which meant that we were in bear territory, which we thought what made the sound. The counselors look at each other with these concerned faces and proceed to take out their bear spray. Almost instantly, we were told to pack up and get back on the trail immediately. We pack up our things, put out the fire, and shined our flashlights to light the way. We find the trail, and as we were getting back on it, we hear clear as day a blood-curdling scream behind us. Almost instantly, everyone comes to a complete stop, and we shine our flashlights by a few trees where we heard it. I'm not sure what it was, but something about the scream really unsettled me. It almost didn't sound human. One of our senior counselors tells us to run and to not look back while he radioed security of the camp. As we were running, the scream was heard again, this time a lot louder, indicating that whatever this was following us. We run for a good few minutes with some of the younger campers nearly crying before we got back to camp. Waiting for us at the lodge was a pair of rangers who had questioned our counselors while we stayed indoors. Rangers and the SOC had went to the area where we had heard the screams, but were unable to find anything. This meant that whoever or whatever it was never followed us out of those woods. For those of you who don't know what the SOC is, it's basically the Police of the Woods, which stands for the Summit Operations Center. They basically get dispatched for situations if someone goes missing, a threat to the camp, or any natural hazards. I remember us having to cut the trip early that night, with a bus coming to pick us up in the morning. Our parents were obviously informed about what had happened, with some even pulling their children out of the camp program. It was a sad turnout, but at the end of the day, I could understand why they chose to. I stuck around with that summer camp for a couple more years before finally leaving once I got into my high school years. What was once a nice summer camp full of awesome activities, only to be turned into something much more upsetting. Up until now, that day still brings back those memories of what happened. I have a few theories as to what actually happened that night, but they're too complicated to explain. This just goes to show you that nothing good happens in the woods. This happened back in 2006 at a sleepaway camp in rural Georgia. I was around 13 years old, and it was the midsummer, meaning no school for a whole 3 months. I'd always go to sleepaway camp every summer, and it was a pretty good experience if you wanted to get out more. It was a 5-week trip, and for the first 2 weeks, things went pretty well with tons of activities us young teens would be into. One night, one of our head counselors had told us that we'd be doing an optional early morning activity. It was an annual ritual the campers did called the Polar Bear Ice Challenge. Basically, how it worked was one of the counselors would throw in a watermelon at the bottom of a lake and the first person to find and grab it won a prize. However, the only hazard was that the water was extremely cold, even during the summer. It was a meaningless activity, but we enjoyed doing it. The next morning at around 6 a.m., the campers who had volunteered woke up and two of our counselors led us to the lake. The counselors lined us up on the dock and explained the rules. No teaming, no horseplaying, no fighting, etc. That being said, he grabbed the watermelon, threw it into the lake, and blew the whistle. We all dive in and were met with the extreme coldness that almost caused us to get out. I tried diving back into the water to try and feel for the melon when something grabs my foot and starts pulling. Figuring it was another camper, I tried resisting to make him let go. It was then when I realized that whatever was pulling me didn't feel like a hand. It felt so abnormal, I couldn't see what it was. After what seemed like forever, I managed to go to the surface where I could see all of the scouts on the bank looking at me. One of the counselors immediately realizes as to what's happening and dives in and manages to make whatever was drowning me let go. He pulls me to shore and everyone is questioning me, but all I could tell them was that something had pulled me. The two counselors look at me, and my ankle is bright red. We go back to camp where my parents and a health assistant were called. The staff at the camp had dismissed the redness as a rash, but none of us bought it. I haven't been back to that site since, and I'm not sure if I ever will. I still don't know what it was that grabbed me. But I sure as hell don't want to find out. It wasn't until a couple of years later where I had brought it up over dinner with my family. My mom and dad looked at me wide-eyed and told me something I didn't know. As it turns out, there was someone who had lived nearby and went into the lake trying to mess with people. He did this by using a metal wire, which is why my ankle was red. That whole campground closed down because of it, and was unable to reopen until the investigation was over. She says I should be very grateful we weren't in that water for too long, as it could have been a whole lot worse. That was the scariest thing that's ever occurred in my life.